Accession number 13932, reel 3.
Mr. Ashcroft, reel 3.
Yes. Well, as it happened, I was then sent back to the field dressing station, and it was at that stage and round that area that I saw many of our wounded on the beach area. Later, I recall, after waiting, we were bombed on the beach. We had various strafing of aircraft, just waiting. I seem to remember sort of being just behind some sort of German fortification. We've been put in the wounded had been put in a sort of a shelter area, and then we were moved off higher up the coast towards Ustrum. And we occupied a sort of a German trench system and a concrete building, which was then the field dressing station. And we had another air raid, and we all had to occupy a slit trench nearby. There were lots of slit trenches used by the Germans, of course, which were very useful for us sheltering. And I well remember a German fighter bomber coming over, flew along the beach, and dropped a bomb it seemed about 250 or 300 yards away, and we were all covered in sand from the blast. Although we were in our slit trench, it had obviously hit the beach, and it had sent a shower of sand. All this sand came down on top of us, and there was much light ACAC fire. And we waited there quite a lot, and I saw some of the wounded come out. I saw officers that had been blinded, hit in the eyes, walking wounded, stretcher cases, and all the documentation was going on, labels, tags, all what they'd given. Ones that had been given morphine, they were sort of a lipstick put on their forehead. I seem to remember a capital M, which had indicated that they'd had morphine. The documentation went on meticulously by the medical authorities, which is the Royal Army Medical Corps. And towards nightfall, we were collected by a Royal Army Service Corps swimming duck vehicle, incredible vehicles which could go on land and swim on water. And we moved towards Lyon-sur-Mer, which was sort of further to the right of our sector, facing the beach as we moved in.
In the dark?
Yes, it was getting dark.
No, in the duck, in the duck. D-U-W.
Yes, in the duck, yes. In the duck, the swimming vehicle. And there was much noise from behind the town, and afterwards we heard that this was an attack by the 21st Panzer Division towards the beach. And just about dusk, we entered a fairly rough sea, and it was rough, and we inflated our... We had these life jackets, and we certainly inflated our life jacket. You wore the life jacket round your waist. We were able to inflate it. And we bobbed up and down. And eventually we swam, and that was the word used for the propelling of these vehicles, out to a landing ship tank, LST. And this tank lowered the sort of ramp at the back. And I can remember this heaving green sea. We must have been a mile or so, would have been a couple of miles out, and the duck just went out of the water and then climbed up. He changed the gear quickly and he climbed up the ramp, and we went into the inside of this tank landing craft in brilliant light, and the whole area was like entering a great hall, and around the side were all bunks. And towards the end were green tents with lights in, and they were the mobile operating theatres. And you could still smell the oil from the tanks, but probably during the day the tanks had been carried across, all the tank crews and the tanks had come out, and the landing ship tank became a mobile hospital. And we were then given sulfonamide pills. I was given trousers down, further injections, further documentations. Some of my fellows were taken for further dressings and things. I can remember further dressings and inoculations, further documentation, and I was allocated a bunk. Oh, and there must have been about probably 300 people there on this tank landing ship. And the ones that were able had a higher bunk. The ones that found it difficult were given a lower bunk. And it was a hospital ship. And they were able to carry out quite sophisticated treatments right from the beaches. And I want to emphasise the sort of medical side of this, how efficient it was. And Monty always said he would look after the wounded, and I began to think at the time, well, you know, he certainly, that side has been taken care of. It was very, very sophisticated. Anyway, we rocked all night. I remember rocking all night. We were at anchor somewhere, or we didn't move that night. And I recall a dawn, we were well fed on basic army rations, and we moved away from the Normandy beaches. And it was difficult to say which direction we were going. I gather we'd probably gone up into the channel, into some of the marshalling areas. And we travelled, it must have been probably a whole day or even a day and a half down the channel, very slowly. I think it was about D plus three, we landed at Tilbury with the ship, the hospital ship.
Had it been men or women looking after you?
There were men. They were all men. I didn't see any, at that stage, on board ship at all. They were all men. But what we did see, and we didn't know what they were at the time, but entering the Thames estuary, I saw some of the Mulberry pontoons, these vast concrete, what appeared to be skyscrapers on the horizon, and we wondered, you know, what the devil is this? And of course it was for the docker operating, it was for the Mulberry Harbour, and obviously they'd been moored somewhere in the Thames estuary, some of them ready to be towed across the channel. But we saw that. So we entered Tilbury, and I believe we were the first wounded to arrive in the United Kingdom, certainly by my hospital ship. Tilbury Hospital, I had an emergency operation there. I don't want to bore you with detail, but after a few days, transferred by ambulance to Cambridge for further checks and operations. And it was at this point then, in the quietness of the hospital, I took stock of the amazing, efficient military exercise. And I thought, you know, I've experienced and... because I always said that my world at that time was just limited to probably 50 yards each side of where I was standing. That was my world in a conflicting situation, and what was going on a broader front was quite irrelevant. So that is basically the first part of it.
Was there any danger, do you think, of your wound going gangrenous?
Yes, I think that's why I had all the, you know, preventative medicine like the sulfonamides and the injection. Of course, sulfonamide had been used then, I think, for the first time, and that was a great thing for anti-gangrenal situations. There was always that worry, but it seemed to be quite... healing, you know, satisfactory.
How long was it before you were fit again?
Well, I was through various medical categories, and I think it was about 6 or 9 months before I was fit again for any sort of active service.
How did you feel going back from the beaches? Did you feel that you were lucky having a blighty wound, or did you feel regret because you weren't with your comrades any longer, or what?
I think there's always that feeling of, you know, that I've survived so far, but there is a feeling that you are sort of missing out. I think it's the esprit de corps of the regiment, really. You know, you feel you don't want to let anybody down, and this sort of collective. But what I'd seen on the beaches and some of the casualties and some of the other casualties, I felt probably I was very fortunate that, you know, that my wound wasn't as serious as some of the others.
What specific casualties had you seen, apart from your CO?
Well, I'd seen people in the water when the tide receded on the Normandy beaches. There's still the wounded soldiers that they hadn't cleared away on the beaches. I'd seen others with gunshot wounds, especially the ones that were stretcher cases. I'd seen ones that had had sort of facial wounds. And, of course, the ones that had been killed on the beaches in that area.
Did you eventually rejoin your unit for active service?
Yes. I didn't go back again to Normandy because, of course, the war was getting towards the end then. But I had some quite interesting experiences in... you know, doing that afterwards into training again. Yeah. After various medical boards, I was pronounced fit enough for, I think, down to category B, and I was posted once again to my old regiment, the 9th South Lancashire Regiment, which then was a primary training centre, which was training the young soldiers for the army. And it was quite interesting there because whilst it was a primary training centre, at one stage we turned it over to the Dutch army. We had the Dutch army training, and we had to learn a little Dutch. And then after that, we retrained a lot of the parachute regiment that had been released from Arnhem. But I was still in a low category, and I didn't get up to a high category until virtually VJ Day. And by that time, of course, we were getting ready and thinking about going towards the Japanese part of the world, which, as you know, the atom bomb intervened and stopped us going there. But... I had some interesting jobs in Southeastern District as a staff captain. It was quite interesting. And thereafter, coming out of the army, I joined the Territorial Army just after the end of the war, and I was the first company commander of the 4th East Lancashire Regiment, TA.
What were your feelings like when the war came to an end? Were there feelings of immense relief or of letdown or anticlimax? Or
no, I think all over was relief. You know, we'd been at war, 6 years? And I think there was a feeling. I think I was especially pleased that I wasn't going into the Japanese theatre of war. That did not appeal to me at all. Because without the atom bomb intervening... I think we should have all finished up in wherever it was, Burma, or I think we'd all been transported to the Far East. So I think that was, we realised that it was going to be, and of course they had then announced the release groups. They'd started actually to release people from the army, so they were obviously going to run the army down. And we were no longer required to go to the Far East. I think that was a relief, if anything.
Can you tell me something about the kinds of wireless equipment that you took across?
Yes. Well, everything in the first place had to be waterproofed. And, of course, like everything else, it had to be weighed in and had to be allocated on transport. And the biggest thing, of course, was it was called the 18 set. It was a very heavy set. It had been waterproofed. Because we expected to land under, we didn't expect a dry shod landing. We expected some of these sets could be submerged in water. But the signalers, and it took two men, one man to carry the set and another to operate it. And they were very heavy sets. And this was the main communication between battalion headquarters and the companies. And the supporting services like the artillery and the machine gunners and the... Army vehicles, Royal Engineers, and the swimming tanks. And also, we also had, once again, there was always a subsidiary link, and the subsidiary link was with a set called the 46 set, which was, in my opinion, much easier to use, a shorter range, but having a fixed crystal frequency, we could change from one channel to another quite quickly. And it was mainly a reserve set, which proved, I gather later on, very, very useful indeed. So we always had a subsidiary method of communication. And, of course, we didn't forget also that with us we had the landline, that where possible it was possible to lay ground lines, which were always much better and more secure than the radio links for interception. But these chaps had to carry, they were very vulnerable with the signallers, really, with this great hump on their back. And they worked marvellously. But that side of it is quite a story.
I see that you were the officer in charge of signals at battalion headquarters. That was your job?
That's right, yes. Hmm.
And who were you directly responsible to?
Well, of course, the the commanding officer, the discipline of the regiment. Virtually, you could argue that any officer that was more senior to myself, but certainly the adjutant and at battalion headquarters and the second in command. Although, as a signal officer, you are given a certain amount of freedom. You have your own transport. We had our dispatch riders, and you could always, before D-Day, you could always borrow a motorcycle if you wanted to go somewhere. But we were self-contained, and of course the signalers were spread throughout the battalion,